I'm going to call to order the meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. We'll start by getting the roll taken.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Katisa Watoon, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Bonner. Representative Demuth.
Present.
Representative Heintzman. Representative Morrison. Representative Pryor. Representative Wasilek.
Present.
Representative West.
So we do not yet have a quorum. I think we'll have a few people coming. I want to apologize, members who are here and members of the public and our presenters, for getting off to such a late start. Sounds like that's true for a lot of folks. We're going to begin, so we'll do the minutes a little bit later. We'll begin with a presentation from the OLA. We have Ms. Hauer here, and so please get settled, and you can state your name for the record when you're ready, and then begin to talk with us about your work in examining early childhood programs. As you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Jody Hauer. I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I'm very pleased to be here this morning to share with you the results of our evaluation of early childhood programs. We released this evaluation in late April of last year, 2018. I'm going to start with just an overview, a quick brief overview of the major findings from our evaluation, and then I'll go into some more detail throughout the presentation. We had five major findings, and the first one is that Minnesota's set of early childhood programs in place when we were evaluating them, which would have been in 2017 leading up to the 2018 report, were quite complex and fragmented. The second is that although we had been asked to identify whether the programs have overlapping services or whether they have duplicative funding, the data were inadequate that we could not tell. It wasn't really possible to determine the extent to which there was possible duplication among the services. The third was that data to measure how effective the programs are was either inadequate or did not exist at all. The fourth finding has to do with the three state agencies that oversee most of the early childhood programs, obviously the Minnesota Department of Education, but also the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health. We found that the existing legal requirements limit the sharing of data among those three agencies. And then the fifth finding was that many children undergo the health and development screening, as is required by law, every year, but data are unavailable on whether all children who are supposed to receive that health and development screening actually do. So by way of background, Minnesota has many, numerous programs that are targeted to young children and their families. At one count, more than 40 such programs are here in our state of Minnesota, but we, in this evaluation, looked at just nine of the major programs. And I'll briefly go through these. The first one, early childhood family education. I'm just going to give a thumbnail, half a minute description of each. I'm sure that you are familiar with most of them. The school districts offer early childhood family education. It usually pairs education for parents with the development of the children, and typically the parent and the child are meeting together in the same classroom. The second program that we examined is early childhood health and development screening. This is the screening that measures the children's height, weight, speech development, and social and emotional well-being. Family home visiting, the title suggests what it is. There are practitioners that come to the homes, typically of women who are pregnant, and meet with those parents as well as with the children through the child's early years. The focus is on supporting the parents in their role as parents, but also in making sure that the children are being raised in safe environments. Head Start. Head Start, of course, is a federal program that promotes school readiness among low-income children. Early Head Start promotes both child development and helps parents move towards self-sufficiency. School Readiness Program in Minnesota. That's primarily for children who are age 3 up through age 5, up to age 5. It focuses on preparing these children for kindergarten. And many school districts around the state offer the School Readiness Program. The sixth program, Voluntary Pre-Kindergarten. This is a program also that is aimed at preparing children for kindergarten, but it's targeted to 4-year-old children. and it's it's been offered by a limited number of school districts and charter schools around the state. I'm not going to get into any further description here. We do have in the full report fact sheets on each one of these programs starting on page 95, so if anybody wants more of those details, they are there. I will note one other addition, and that's the School Readiness Plus program. Again, many of you, I'm sure, have heard of it, know of it. It was established in 2017. It's not to be confused with the School Readiness Program that I spoke about a moment ago. It is intended, though, to prepare four-year-olds for success in kindergarten. The School Readiness Program was started back in 1991, so that's been around for many years. But the School Readiness Plus program, having been established in 2017, that's the year that we began our evaluation research, and so we really don't look in depth at the School Readiness Plus program as we do at the others, just because data weren't available at the time we were conducting the research. Although we did review it, and we do make some references to it in our report. So those are the first six programs that we looked at. There's a second group of programs, and this second group looks not at providing direct services to children, as that first group did. Instead, the second group offers financial assistance to the young children and their families who want to be involved in some of these programs. So in this group, we have two different programs. The first is Child Care Assistance Program. It offers financial help to low-income parents who are either working or looking for work or engaged in training or education that will lead them to work. The second program is the Early Learning Scholarships. Again, it offers financial assistance to families so that their children can participate in the early childhood programs. I do want to make a distinction between the two ways that families can access the scholarships. Again, I know that many of you are already familiar with this, so I'm not going to go into great detail. But Pathway 1 is one way of accessing the scholarships, and that's when individual children and their families apply for and receive a scholarship. In that instance, the children and their families, should they move to another neighborhood or another city, they can take that scholarship with them and then use that in another early learning program or child care program. The second way to access the scholarships is referred to as Pathway 2. Money for those scholarships is awarded instead to the programs, early childhood programs and early learning programs, which in turn will award those scholarships to the low-income children who are either enrolled in their programs or are on the waiting lists there. So the final program that we looked at in our evaluation is the Parent Aware Quality Rating and Improvement System. Parent Aware rates child care providers and also the early learning providers based on standards that have been set in five different areas. One example is the category of teaching and relationships with children. And the providers who participate in Parent Aware are measured against how well they meet the various criteria that are set up in these different, the five different categories. This system is important in this conversation that we're going to have today, because the providers that participate here in Parent Aware, that qualifies them to accept the scholarships that we mentioned a moment ago and also to receive higher reimbursements through the Child Care Assistance Program. I'm going to move on now away from the background information into our findings. We concluded that the variation that exists among the early childhood programs, both in terms of funding requirements and other program requirements, has created a very complex and a fragmented set of programs. And part of that is due to differences in the eligibility for children who want to participate in the programs. And I'm going to give you a few examples here. First, we looked at income eligibility for the programs. So three programs that we reviewed had no eligibility requirement based on income. And those three are the ones on the slide here: early childhood family education, the screening program, and the voluntary pre-kindergarten program. The remaining five programs did have income thresholds for eligibility, but those thresholds differed from one program to the next. And I'll show you on this next slide how that looks. So this slide depicts the income limits for a family of four in 2017. And you can see, if you look at the left-hand side, that the income eligibility ranged at that lowest point, $24,600 for the Head Start program, all the way up to over $64,000 for one of the sub-programs in child care assistance. The only other thing I'd want to point out to you on this particular slide is, if you look at the second column from the left, the School Readiness Program, that has two numbers listed. That's because the lower limit is for children that qualify for the school district's free lunch program, whereas the higher limit, the $45,000 limit, that's for children who qualify for reduced price lunches. Another area with differences among the programs that we evaluated is in the staffing requirements. I'm going to talk about a few of them today. We do have them all of them listed on page 22 of the full report, if you care to look at that. But today I'm going to call your attention to the third row on this particular slide. It's labeled salary requirement. You see only one check mark if you follow that row across to the voluntary pre-kindergarten column. And that indicates that only voluntary pre-kindergarten has a salary requirement in law. And the law states that those districts have to pay teacher salaries to voluntary pre-kindergarten teachers that are comparable to those paid for teachers in the K-12 grades. Regarding licensure of staff, again, there's a mix of requirements among the programs. The fourth row is labeled teacher licensure. If you'd look there at this point, this shows that statutes require the instructors to be licensed if they're teaching in early child family education or if they're teaching in the School Readiness Plus program. However, teachers do not need to be licensed if they are in the other programs, either school readiness or voluntary pre-kindergarten. Then regarding requirements for program supervisors, again, there's a mix. Supervisors must be licensed if they are supervising early childhood family education or if they're supervising the school readiness program. But they don't need to be licensed as supervisors if they are supervising School Readiness Plus or the voluntary pre-kindergarten program. Each one of the programs has its own funding stream, and there are differences in the requirements related to them based on how they are funded. I'm going to give a few examples here too. So for two of the programs that are overseen by the Minnesota Department of Education, so these two are the voluntary pre-kindergarten program and the Pathway 2 form of the scholarships program, school districts and other providers have to compete for that funding. That is, they apply every year to the Department of Education, who then will determine who receives that amount of scholarships based on criteria that are set in law. Another difference is on the use of user fees. If you look at the second row on this particular table, you see that there are two programs, the Early Childhood Family Education Program and the School Readiness Program. They have authority to charge user fees. Other programs do not. However, I wanted to point out that with voluntary pre-kindergarten, for the most part, that program is prohibited from using user fees, but there is an exception. The exception is for school districts that are applying for the funding for voluntary pre-kindergarten, they have, say, 15 children who are four years old and want to participate in voluntary pre-kindergarten. They get funding for those 15, but then it turns out they actually have another 5 children who are 4 years old and want to participate. In those instances, the voluntary pre-kindergarten program administrators have authority to look at other sources of funding, one of which is charging fees for those additional 5 children. The third difference I'll point out on this table is the last row that has to do with the responsibility for transporting children to the programs at the schools. Because voluntary pre-kindergarten is a program that relies on general education funding, the school districts are responsible for transporting these participants, just like they are responsible for transporting K through 12 students if those students live 2 or more miles away from the school building. This transportation requirement does not apply to the other early childhood programs that are funded differently. We have recommended that the legislature consider aligning some of these differences to make them more congruent among the different programs, both in terms of funding and eligibility requirements. We think that this could be a benefit both to the users of the program as well as to the local providers of the programs. We think it's possible that if the state does take the steps towards better alignment, that the state could eventually come to the point where it could use a common single application form to determine eligibility for a variety of the programs, school readiness program, the voluntary pre-kindergarten program, School Readiness Plus, the scholarships, and even possibly Head Start, even though that's a federal program. Aligning the program funding requirements could improve the efficiency of paying for these programs. They rely now on these multiple funding streams from the state. We think that the state could be looking at how we can allow school districts and others to combine these revenue streams to the maximum extent possible, recognizing that many of these programs are targeted to children in low-income families. We also think that aligning the program requirements between child care assistance and the scholarship programs could help reduce some of the existing problems that the providers have that we heard about when we were conducting this evaluation. For instance, one provider told us that there are differences in the billing cycles for each of these two programs, for the child care assistance program and the scholarships program. And that just created a lot of inefficiencies for the providers from the administrative standpoint. One approach to this recommendation would be to have the legislature convene a working group that would discuss the changes needed to improve alignment among the programs. And we think that working group should be established would then eventually make recommendations to the full legislature for change. I'm going to move on now to another of our findings. So before we began this study, of course, many of you, I think, know that the Office of the Legislative Auditor conducts evaluations when the Legislative Audit Commission directs us to undertake certain topics. And at that time, we try to listen to what the concerns are of legislators about the topics they have selected. And one of the things that some legislators had asked to do when we conducted this evaluation was to determine whether the services that are being provided in the early childhood programs, whether they overlap or whether there's duplicative funding for these programs. Well, overall, our finding was that it's not possible to determine the extent of potential duplication in early childhood funding or in the services. And this is for a couple of reasons that I'll talk about here briefly. First, to do this, one would need an accurate way of identifying individual children that might be enrolled across multiple programs. But the Department of Education, the Department of Health, and the Department of Human Services each use a different method for assigning ID numbers to the children that are in their programs. Beyond that, the state has, and I'm sure you've heard about this to some degree, the state has an early childhood longitudinal data system. It's housed at the Department of Education. But this data system contains data from across many programs and many state agencies. So we thought perhaps this might be a vehicle to help the state in identifying children who potentially receive duplicative services. And we looked into that, and our conclusions were that, first of all, the data system was not set up for that purpose, and so it would not be an easy fix to make it work for that purpose. Plus, the longitudinal data system did not have complete data. For instance, it did not contain data on the voluntary pre-kindergarten program. I know that the department had planned to add enrollment data for the voluntary pre-kindergarten program, but at the time we did our work, the system did not include anything on that program. As another example, the data system had data from only about half of the state's Head Start agencies. And then beyond that, the Department of Education does have data in this system on children who registered for the school readiness program, but the department did not collect data on children who actually participated in that program or the dates that they attended. Moreover, to determine whether children receive duplicative services would require information on how the local school districts are implementing their programs. For instance, some school districts have combined funding streams from the school readiness program and the voluntary pre-kindergarten program, not to have separate programs, but as a way to provide a single program and enhance it. And by enhancing it, I mean going perhaps from a 3-day per week program up to a 5-day per week, or in several other ways of adding to the program that had been in place already. But knowing which school districts do or do not combine funding in this way would be very necessary to help identify possible duplication, but the data were not available. We did have some data that I want to talk about now on children who received funding from two separate funding sources, two separate streams of funding. So of children who used a scholarship awarded back in fiscal year 2016, we found that about 15% of them paid for the services that they attended in part with the scholarship and in part with child care assistance money. Well, we concluded, though, that that does not indicate duplicative funding. The programs are set up in a way that the providers will first bill the child care assistance program for the services that are being used, and then scholarships come in to fill in as much as possible of the remaining charges. So at least for this group, it did not indicate duplicate of funding. We also had data on children who had been registered in two programs during fiscal year 2017. About 27% of children who had been enrolled in voluntary pre-kindergarten were also enrolled in school readiness. However, the data were not available to give us the dates of participation for those children in school readiness to show whether they were participating in both programs concurrently. Furthermore, as I stated a moment ago, we know anecdotally that school districts have combined these two funding streams in the past to enhance an existing single program. So we concluded that this is not an example of overlapping services. However, with the data available, we really couldn't reach a firm conclusion on a statewide basis.
Ms. Howard, would you mind receiving questions in the middle of your presentation? Is that okay with you?
Mr. Chair, certainly.
Okay. We have one from Representative Cotiza Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just hopeful to clarify multiple funding streams. When you talk about Pathway 1 and Pathway 2, I know that a lot of the package gets put together behind the scenes, and so the family isn't necessarily aware of all the different ways that their programming is being paid for. Could potentially a child be qualified for the Pathway 1 scholarship that they apply for and they're aware of, as well as receiving some Pathway 2 funding through the provider?
Ms. Sauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I actually don't know the answer to your question. I'm sorry. I should know that, but I don't know. My inclination is to say that they would receive one scholarship through the Pathway 1, perhaps, but not through Pathway 2. But I'm hoping that the Department of Education representatives can clarify that. I'm sorry. I don't know that off the top of my head.
Not a problem.
And we will be having an MDE presentation after this. That
might
be a good time for that.
I will follow up then, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Howard, please continue.
Well, as a result, we recommend that the Minnesota Departments of Education, Health, and Human Services jointly identify what would be needed to use a universal identification number for the children that participate in their various programs. One possibility is to expand the use of the Department of Education's state student identification number. They now use that to assign ID numbers to kids, but that's not the only option. So we think that the three agencies should jointly list possible alternatives and then determine what would be needed to make one of those work. We also recommend that the Department of Education consistently collect attendance data and also dates of participation for the children in the programs that it oversees. I'm going to move on now to our finding on the effectiveness and the impact of these programs. We concluded that while some programs are required by law to report on aspects of their effectiveness and others are not, the existing data are inadequate to evaluate how effective the programs actually are. Minnesota does have statutes that are referred to as the world's best workforce statutes. As the name suggests, the intent of that statute is to have in our state the world's best workforce. The statutes do include five goals to get the state to the point where we'll have the world's best workforce. One of those is a goal that is all children meet school readiness goals. We looked for information to see whether we could measure how well Minnesota is getting to that point, but data did not exist to measure whether children statewide are ready for school. We reviewed some of the differences that existed in law for assessing school readiness for children, and I'm going to explain some of them here. Now, in this slide, I'm focusing on program differences that exist in our state statutes, so I'm going to, for the purposes this morning, I'm going to avoid talking about Head Start, but I'll refer you to the middle column here on this slide that's entitled Voluntary Pre-Kindergarten. Now, the law requires the voluntary pre-kindergarten programs to measure children's skills, their readiness for school, twice. Once when the child enters the program and again when the child leaves. The statutes also require that the assessment is aligned with the state's early learning standards. And these are the standards on what young children should be expected to know and to do at various ages. Statutes also require that the programs use a state-approved assessment tool. Now, if you look in contrast to the final column in this particular table, which the column is labeled School Readiness Program, you see that the statutes do require that program to assess whether its enrolled children are ready for school, but the statutes do not require assessment tools that are aligned with the state's early learning standards, and nor do they require use of a state-approved assessment tool. We compared differences in requirements on assessing school readiness between the early childhood programs that we're focusing on this morning and also kindergarten. We do not have in Minnesota statutes that require school districts to assess school readiness of children as they enter kindergarten. But we did learn that many school districts and charter schools around the state already do assess school readiness for their kindergartners. As a part of our evaluation, we conducted a survey that went to all school districts and to charter schools around the state. And we asked many things, but one of the things we asked about was to what extent they assess school readiness for their children who are entering kindergarten. And we found that 81% of the school districts and charter schools assessed all of their kindergarten children for the 2016-2017 school year. Only 3% of the school districts and charter schools reported assessing none of the children who were entering kindergarten that year. Now, the Department of Education has approved 4 separate assessment tools, and they were looking for tools that could be considered to be valid, reliable, and that were aligned with the early learning standards. We did ask about this on the survey I mentioned, and in response, we learned that 49% of the school districts and charter schools that did assess children as they entered kindergarten used tools other than the 4 tools that the department had approved. Now, we think that's important because it's really not known whether the tools that are in use have been tested, whether they are valid, whether they are aligned with the state's early learning standards. So we recommend that, well, first of all, I want to say that as the laws were when we were conducting this evaluation, the statutes brought our state only part of the way to the point where we can know how many children who are completing the early childhood programs are actually prepared to begin school. So we make some recommendations. The first is that the legislature would consider requiring assessments of all children's school readiness as they complete the early childhood programs. We think that this requirement should eventually apply to all of the publicly funded programs that do have a parent aware rating. Now, this is a huge undertaking. This is not a simple thing to do, and it would likely have to be phased in. The programs would be required to use an approved assessment tool. So school districts that now use a tool that was developed in-house would not be allowed to use it unless that tool had been tested and shown to be reliable and aligned with the early learning standards. This is important because without knowing that the tools are assessing and measuring the same things, we really won't know whether those tools are appropriately capturing what children know and can do in terms of readiness for kindergarten. The recommendation also suggests that programs would have to report their assessment results to the state. Currently, this is not required. Furthermore, if the legislature continues to endorse the world's best workforce statute that I described briefly earlier, especially the goal that all children must meet school readiness goals, the legislature should require assessments of school readiness for children who are entering kindergarten. This is needed if Minnesota is going to know whether all children statewide meet school readiness goals. If the state's going to understand whether the childhood programs are effective, what the actual impact is of the programs, it has to collect and analyze appropriate information. So one piece of that certainly would be the assessment of children's school readiness, but by itself, that would be insufficient. We recommend that the legislature should specify the general outcomes it would expect to get from an evaluation of program impacts. Then we think that each of the 3 departments, Department of Education, Department of Health, and Department of Human Services, would identify appropriate indicators to measure impact for the programs that they oversee. And together, we think they would identify jointly indicators of effectiveness that would cut across the more than one of the programs. And ultimately, we think that this effort would result in something coming to the legislature to determine whether they want to proceed with the resulting plan. Moving on to another finding, We found that state and federal laws limit the sharing of data among the three state agencies that oversee these early childhood programs. Now, there are state and federal laws that protect the identity of individual children. These laws prohibit agencies from disclosing data, individual level data, except under very specific circumstances. I mean, one example of the exception is when the subject of the data has given informed consent to share the data with others. Now, we don't want to minimize the importance of those protections. We think they are important, but they can prevent inefficiencies among the agency's operations. As one example, the Department of Human Services could not share data with the Department of Education on the recipients of child care assistance, even though that information could potentially help the Department of Education determine income eligibility for the scholarship program. We recommend that the legislature consider broadening the authority for these three departments to share individual level data from the early childhood programs. As a first step here, we would suggest that the three state agencies jointly come together, identify the specific statutes that most affect their and most limit their ability to share data in a manner that would benefit children. Our final area of findings and recommendations have to do with early childhood health and development screening. Minnesota law requires all children in public school to undergo an early childhood health and development screening before kindergarten or within 30 days of enrolling. An exception is made for those children whose parents file a conscientious objection to the screening. We learned that the Department of Education does collect from school districts a variety of information on the screening programs, including the number for which a conscientious objection has been filed, but it has not collected information on whether all children receive the screening. So our recommendation here is fairly simple, that the Department of Education should collect data on the number of public school children who are not getting that health and development screening. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I just conclude by saying that we make a number of recommendations. Some of them are major recommendations that would require a lot of resources, but we think that those are necessary if they're going to address the problems that we found. The complex and fragmented nature of the set of early childhood programs the state has, the lack of data on whether children are ready for school, insufficient data on what are the impacts of these programs, the restrictions on data sharing among the state agencies, and the missing data on the number of children who are not undergoing the health and development screening. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks. I'll be glad to answer some questions.
Thank you, Ms. Howard. Our first question comes from Representative Cotiza-Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Howard, I just want to clarify. So this unknown number of children who are not screened, when they start kindergarten or register that they're going to be homeschooling, we can determine that number. But what sort of recommendation is OLA making in order to collect data on children who are not screened if they are not participating in that process and not conscientiously objecting?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a matter of the State Department of Education collecting that data from the districts so that we have on a statewide level information on the number of children who have not been screened. You're absolutely right. I mean, most school districts could tell us what that number of children is. But the point is that even though the department has collected quite a bit of data from the districts on what their screening programs consist of and how they might be improved, they have not collected data on children who have not gone through the screening, with the exception of those that have the conscientious objections.
Okay. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here for to testify. It's very enlightening. And I apologize in advance. I actually have a few questions. The first one is kind of a follow-up on Representative Cotiza-Witun's question. I know we talked a little bit about conscientious objectors. Is there currently a mechanism where parents could actually have their children screened but simply not share that data with staff or teachers, but they could receive that report individually?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, in fact, school districts, many of them told us, well, it differed around the state, but I'm thinking, for instance, of some of the larger districts in St. Paul. Several families there opted against using the screening that the district offered, but instead used their private medical provider to conduct a screening of the child. The disconnect comes in transmitting the information from those privately provided screenings to the district. And I know that the district has taken some steps to try to overcome that, but I think that they are still seeing some difficulties in actually getting that information. But you're absolutely right. It's certainly an option for families if they care to go that route.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one other, speaking to the data, so I will tell you first off that I have a little bit different lens. I come from the IT world. And so data is something that is first and foremost in our minds. And so there's a little bit of a question here in, and I understand that the public may not understand what I'm about to say to some degree, but my question is this. I am assuming that when we look at this data, that there is some way in which we're aggregating this data in a de-identified manner. Is that accurate?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sorry, I don't know what a de-identified manner is.
Sure, let me explain. In other words, we might have, rather than having a child's name or address or phone number or information that could identify an ICE-specific child, we might instead aggregate that data, say, using a universal ID number or something of that nature so that we can see the overall picture that the data is trying to tell, but we won't necessarily be identifying a specific child within that data that could be personal information.
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. I just wasn't familiar with the term, but I'm certainly familiar with the concept. Yes, so right now there are opportunities for sharing data that have been de-identified, to use your terminology. That does limit what some would hope to be able to achieve if more individual-level data could be shared. The thought is that with some individual-level data, for instance, the example I gave was that the Department of Education would be able to see that a child had qualified for the Child Care Assistance Program and then use that information to determine eligibility for a scholarship. From the school district level, the actual school would like to have more individual information so that they could understand what kinds of steps they might need to take to follow up with a family or with a child to make sure that all of their needs are being met. But it's that individual level data that I think is the crux of the issue here. Now, as I said, statutes do have a number of, there were over 30-some provisions that provided exemptions from the law that restricted sharing data. So there are some provisions already in law for certain circumstances when individual level data can be shared. And we're saying that we think that that should be extended a bit further to include these early childhood programs under the circumstances where the benefit of sharing that information could really be attainable for the child.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. So let me just make sure I'm understanding. So I do appreciate that on some level when we're talking about things like eligibility for programs, there's a need to identify a specific child, obviously. That makes sense, right? But I think one of the overlying themes that we discussed today was that in terms of trying to understand the scope of the issues that we have and the consistencies or lack thereof across programs was that we just didn't really have the ability to have good data. And I guess what I'm driving at is if we have a mechanism to de-identify that data and collect it from various sources to get that larger picture, it seems like we should be able to talk about how we do that to get that all of that data into one source so that we could actually see that larger picture. And I'm not talking about the individual assessment of whether someone qualifies for a program per se, and speaking to an individual child, overall is what I was trying to get at. Does that make sense?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. And I think that that is kind of the crux of the issue, and that I think that's what we're trying to achieve here by expanding the authority of the the legal authority for the departments to share data of that nature. You know, right now, even with the longitudinal data system that I mentioned, it's very difficult to do any comparisons of children with that data because there are many children whose names are the same, and there isn't a unique identifying number to tell us that John Smith over here is the same or different from the John Smith over there. So that's why we couple our recommendation with the need to have a unique identifying number for each of the children, regardless of whether they're in a program that the Department of Human Services oversees or the Department of Education oversees or the Department of Health oversees.
Okay. Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that, and I think that makes very good sense, and I certainly appreciate that. And so perhaps that's something that we should explore as the committee to talk more about how we do that, so we can get better data on that information. I did have one, two other questions.
No, that's okay.
Okay.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the indulgence. On the slide number 17, where you were talking about the assessment requirements differing, and we talked a little bit about the school readiness program and the fact that it doesn't necessarily align with standards and that the tool must be state approved. I'm just wondering why those don't align. Is there a specific reason why the school readiness programs do not align?
Mr. Chair and Representative,
Ms. Hauer.
In part, it's a feature of the fact that school readiness program has been around for a couple of decades. The voluntary pre-kindergarten program was established in 2016, I think. It's much newer. And so the laws that were created for the newer program differed from the statutes that applied to the school readiness program, which has been around since the 80s or late 80s or somewhere in there. But beyond that, I don't know that anybody has really looked at previously whether or to what extent there were differences in the assessment requirements for these two different programs. So this was, it became evident to us when we were looking at the statutes and comparing one program against another, but I don't know that this has just been discussed before in this kind of a overall viewpoint.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. So there is no overall logistical reason why they can't match up.
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, logistically, there could be certainly administrative problems because the tools used to assess the children differ from one district to another. Now, it doesn't seem to me that, maybe again the professionals from the Department of Education can speak to this, but from what we learned, it doesn't seem to me that there would be a problem with using the same tool to assess readiness of children who are in the voluntary pre-kindergarten program versus children who went through instead the school readiness program. Again, I'm hoping that someone later can affirm that. So I think in terms of logistics, it's really just making sure that the assessment tools we use are ones that appropriately capture the information on what children can and should know and in preparation for their time in kindergarten. If we can make sure that we have a variety of assessment tools, but that do meet those criteria, I think that's the biggest kind of logistical, or at least one of the biggest logistical hurdles to come over. And that does require resources. It's going to require some time and some money to make sure that the assessment tools in use do meet those criteria.
And Representative Bonner, it does seem to me this may be a good line of questioning for the agency when they present next. So, but did you have something else, okay. Representative Bonner?
Okay. I do.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Howard. There was one other quick question, and I don't know if you will know the answer to this, but I'm just curious. We mentioned that about 3% of the children do not go through any kind of assessment for pre-K, either public or charter schools. Do we have any sense or have we heard any rationale for why those schools do not conduct an assessment?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that the 3% refers to the number of school districts and percentage of school districts and charter schools that did not fully assess all of their incoming kindergartners. So it's not at 3% of the children, it's 3% of the school districts and charter schools that responded to our survey. But having said that, one, we did ask as a part of the survey, if you're not assessing all the children, what are the reasons why not? I mean, one of the reasons that came up was the cost. I mean, there is a cost associated with it. The school districts do get a reimbursement for their health and development assessments from the state, but a lot of the districts that we spoke with when we went around the state interviewing them said that was insufficient, that the amount of the reimbursement really didn't cover their costs. So I know that's one of the reasons. And there are others which I'd be glad to, I can't think of them off the top of my head, I'd be glad to look them up from our survey results and communicate those to you, but I remember that cost was one of the big issues that they raised.
Representative Bonner, are you all done? Is that right? Okay. All right.
I'm good.
Okay. We have another member question. I want to make sure that we move to the agency too. But Ms. Howard, just quickly for you, I know that the OLA had a January 2019 update to your report from last spring, and I guess I thought it would be in our packets. I think there was some miscommunication. We had looked on your website, but do you know where that's, is that available online, or is that something you can get to us?
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to get copies for you. Yes, it is available online, and I can certainly talk with the committee staff. Or we can, after the meeting, I can certainly make sure we get copies sent to you.
Thank you. We may look online, too, while we're in the final half an hour here, see if we can get copies into members' hands. So Representative Morrison had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation, Ms. Howard. I'm stunned to learn that we don't know how many children are not screened. And I appreciate your sounding the alarm on this and other issues that you presented this morning. I'm wondering if we know more about the conscientious objections. Are we able to tease out the reasons, or is that just a wastebasket term?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think we do know the reasons. As I recall, it's not like the family has to submit their explanation for why they object. They just have to sign a form that says they do object. So I don't know that even at the district level, certainly not at the State Department level, but I don't think even at the school district level, they're going to be collecting those data.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? So let's move on to having our agency presentation. As folks are coming up, I want to make sure that we address the minutes from our most recent meeting, because we do now have a quorum. May I have a motion to approve the minutes from our most recent meeting?
So moved.
Okay, Representative Morrison is moving approval of the minutes. Any additions or corrections? And seeing none, all in favor of approval, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the minutes are approved. So now we have presentation by the agencies. I think the Ms. Howard is going to be sticking around for the rest of the of the committee hearing, so we'll be available. But please, Ms. Byrne, if you can identify yourself for the record and feel free to begin your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Long time no see.
I'm spending a lot of time with us, Ms. Byrne. Thank you for that.
So I'm here today to, one, to respond to some of your questions around the progress we've been making on the OLA recommendations, as well as our preschool development grant, which are kind of intertwined. So which would you like first? Would you like me to go through the preschool development grant, which will address some of the OLA recommendations, or?
We'd really leave that up to you, Ms. Burnham, as to what you think is the most helpful way to lay the information out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so the OLA recommendations, I really want to thank Ms. Howard and her team and the whole OLA process that happened last year. It was really beneficial, and as you can see in the letters of support at the end of the report, that all three agencies who were engaged in this audit were very supportive of all the recommendations, and quite frankly, glad that they are on paper and out in the open to be addressed. So I will go through the OLA recommendations. As you will hear in a minute, a lot of the OLA recommendations are going to be addressed through this one-year federal preschool development grant that we recently received. And so the first recommendation is around the universal identifier. And I think many of the questions were around our lack of ability to collect data. And right after this report came out, we began conversations across agency and with our partners at MMB around what is needed and what currently exists and what are the roadblocks to this universal identifier. Currently, all three agencies have an identifier. They just are not the same. So for several months, even prior to receiving the preschool development grant, we've had a cross-agency team working together on identifying and exploring what is needed to create this universal identifier. And so based on that work to date, we've identified three primary paths for further exploration. And this preschool development grant is a planning grant, which is going to give us a year to continue this exploration, as well as some fiscal resources to engage our MINUTE staff in helping us know what the cost implications could be. So our first pathway is exploring whether an existing data system that already facilitates this type of data sharing for participants in a number of early childhood programs examined in the OLA report, such as the Early Childhood Longitudinal Data System, could be used to facilitate some of the envisioned uses while preserving the privacy of children participating and families. The system is designed for retrospective research rather than real-time management and reporting. It uses matching algorithms rather than a universal identification number to match participant data across agencies and data systems. So we are looking at how the ECLDS could be used, possibly expanding it and maybe using it differently. The second option is exploring whether any other existing processes for sharing matched data between agencies could be expanded to facilitate the envisioned uses. And the third is identifying spotlight local partners who are currently sharing matched data in ways that facilitate desired results. So we will continue through this next year and through the leadership of the Children's Cabinet to explore those three options. So I'm happy to say that universal identifier is a top priority in our federal grant priorities. The recommendation around attendance rates. MDE currently collects attendance rates and dates of participation from children enrolled in voluntary pre-K, school readiness plus, and early childhood special education. New this year is the addition of preschool participation in the Minnesota report card, which is a requirement of our state ESSA plan. So we will again be doing a better job at collecting attendance rates in those programs. The recommendation around collecting data from school districts on the number of children who are not screened. So currently, MDE is not authorized in statute to collect data, this data set on children not enrolled in public pre-K or kindergarten. MDE has proposed a new data collection system that is going to be integrated with some other current data warehouse work that's being done at the agency. And that would be used by the partnering with the early childhood special education that they're required to report and collect certain data at the federal level. And I mentioned maybe in the last couple presentations that we are working on a system at MDE to integrate several data points, and this being one of them. So we're hoping to collect the total number of kindergartners without early learning screening. At this point, we had some money allocated and budgeted in one of our MINUTE activities, and MINUTE had some capacity issues, so it's still on their priority list, so we are hoping that this gets started soon with our partners at MINUTE. And the recommendation around a comprehensive approach for evaluating the impact of our early childhood programs. Again, this is going to be part of our year one activities in the preschool development grant, which I'll talk about here in a minute.
And Ms. Burnham, I just want to make sure you're not working off of a presentation that we don't have, right?
I'm just describing. I'm working off. No, I don't have a presentation. Okay. I'm just kind of giving you an oral update. And this update will be provided to you through the memo that you asked Ms. Hauer for, the OLA update, which has been even updated even more recently, which I will send to you. So you will get this information in the form of a memo.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Please continue. Okay.
I'm just verbally giving you the update to try to answer some of the questions you had. So MDH and DHS and MDE would need legislative authority and the resources necessary to develop a comprehensive evaluation plan. And again, this activity is planned in our preschool development grant. And let's see, consider aligning funding and eligibility. Again, this is another cross-agency partnership that we've had going for several months with the Children's Cabinet. We've been working closely with the Department of Admin's Continuous Improvement Division, and they are really helping us sort out ways and possibilities for that aligning eligibility criteria, as well as how we might look at combining some of the application processes. So that's a work in progress as well. And the two recommendations around collecting, requiring assessments of all children's school readiness as they complete certain early childhood programs. Again, that's, as Ms. Hauer mentioned, that's a big undertaking. It would be looking at all the parent-aware rated programs as well as all the school-based programs. And we do have some components of the system in place, but scaling up statewide would take time and additional funding. So with that, I'm going to give you a brief overview of the preschool development grant, which I believe is on your slide. So the 45 states were awarded these one-year planning grants from the Federal Department of Human Services. And over the past year and a half to 2 years, there's been a cross-agency effort working with quite a diverse members of the community, and we call that effort the Early Childhood System Reform. And this effort through the last year and a half has produced a report and several recommendations. And in that work with the Early Childhood Systems Reform and this group of stakeholders, they identified a mission that has been adopted by the Children's Cabinet and many other early childhood organizations and the work within the agency. And so a statewide conversation around this work involves unifying around this common mission, which is by focusing on children facing racial, geographic, and economic inequities, children in Minnesota will be born healthy and able to thrive within their families and communities. So this mission is really guiding the work of the preschool development grant. And in conversations through the application process of the preschool development grant, we identified the goal of Minnesota's preschool development grant, birth through five grant and related activities will support the overall goal to more efficiently align and coordinate our systems in order to ease navigation through the system for families. So you can see that the mission and the goal right there are well aligned with the Office of the Legislative Auditor report. And not far from our writing in this grant was the OLA report, so we really took to heart all those recommendations and tried to address them in the writing of this application. So quick facts, this is a one-year planning grant. It's a partnership between the Departments of Education, Health, and Human Services and the Children's Cabinet. Department of Ed is serving as the fiscal host. As I mentioned, 45 states and territories were awarded the grant. The award amount for Minnesota was just over $4.7 million. In the timeline, the award was given to us at the end of December and has a projected end date of January 2020. That timeline is a little unique because at the federal level, they've had some technical difficulties in producing the official award notification. And because of that, they've already given us an extension of a month. And another quick note is any state, any of these 45 states who requested a budget of over $1 million were asked to reduce their budget by 29%. So you may be aware that Minnesota was asked, along with about 39 other states, to reduce their budget by that amount. Again, I wanted to note this is a one-year planning grant. This grant is not meant to serve children or increase access. It's purely for state departments and state systems to do a comprehensive needs assessment and develop a strategic plan for birth through age five children across state systems. We will have an opportunity next fall to apply for a phase two implementation grant. That grant will be much more competitive, and we project the application window being from August and being due in October. If funded, it'll be a three-year grant, and it will require a 30% state match. And we would have had to have been awarded a planning grant in order to be eligible to apply for the implementation grant.
Ms. Burnham, can I just, this may be a question for fiscal staff, but how the 30% match would work if you're applying in the fall of 2019, I assume there'd be some sort of funding that would need to be approved by the legislature for, where would that money come from? I don't know, Ms. Burnham, if you know, or if our fiscal staff can help.
Mr. Chair, that's a good question, and I'd be happy to provide you greater detail on that. Right now, there was a 30% match required for this planning grant, so each department committed about $500,000 in current activities, mostly in-kind type activities.
Okay. Perhaps it'd be similar.
Okay. Yes.
Please continue.
So the preschool development grant has five priorities. One, the top two priorities are activities, conducting a needs assessment and developing a strategic plan are the top two priorities at the federal level as well as the state level. And this visual gives you an idea of some key actions that will take place under each activity. Under the statewide needs assessment, through the process that was completed through the early childhood systems reform, it became very apparent, and the community voices were very loud and strong about the need to engage community stakeholders, diverse community stakeholders. So as part of this statewide needs assessment, we will be conducting about 30 statewide regional stakeholder engagement meetings. We will be contracting with regional partners to facilitate this stakeholder engagement. And we are in the process now of just identifying the types of questions and priorities that will be part of this stakeholder engagement process. Some of the partners include the Minnesota Initiative, Foundations, MNTREC, Indigenous Envisioning. It's very important, again, that we prioritize getting a diverse community voice engaged in this needs assessment. From the needs assessment data, we will develop a strategic plan. Our hope is that this strategic plan will be a 5 to 10 year plan. Even though this grant focuses on birth through age five, as I mentioned in my previous presentations, the work across agencies is really focused on prenatal through age eight, so that prenatal through third grade learning continuum. So any strategic plan that we develop in this process will be linked to that early elementary K through 3 years as well. Other priorities in this activity under activity three is designing a mixed delivery system that maximizes parental choice. And this involves developing really intentional communication and outreach strategies. We are looking at, and this will come out through the needs assessment, what might a central intake regional system look like, or a hub model where a system like a Help Me Grow system may live regionally and help navigate the service, the multiple number of services implemented through county and states into one area to make it easier for families to navigate. We're also looking at how we can better promote and build capacity of culturally relevant policies and practices, and expanding the work of our P3 leadership series. And then with activity four, we're looking at how we can promote best practices. So we're looking at how we can develop local communities of practice so they can share what's working within their communities with each other. There's quite a few workforce enhancements that are part of activity four. We're also looking at how we can build and strengthen the capacity of educators around serving dual language learners. And we're working with our partners in Department of Health around designing a trauma-informed training model and curriculum, as well as looking at how we can, and this goes to the data collection and having some data that shows the impact of our early childhood investments, looking at how to support transitions from the pre-K year into the kindergarten year. And so that includes a multiple of factors, not only looking at child outcome data, but looking at program data and family perspective.
And Ms. Burnham, I want to make sure to leave some time for member questions, so if you can wrap up in two minutes or so.
Five is pretty, Mr. Chair. Activity five is we cannot start on activity five activities until we finish our strategic plan and needs assessment. So that those activities are kind of low-hanging fruit. I believe that this is my last slide. Again, it's just highlighting the fact that we're engaging a cross-section of community partners from all regions of the state to ensure that the diverse community voice is heard. This just gives a visual of kind of the roles and responsibilities across the state agencies.
Thank you, Ms. Burnham. We have a question from Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the presentation. It's really good to know that this is going to be looked at in such a comprehensive way, and that there has been support for doing it from the federal government. Obviously, these two ports go together. So when you're going through that, I had a couple thoughts. First is very, very glad to hear that trauma-informed is part of the best practices. Especially as we're talking about data and being able to identify a child and make sure that we keep talking about the same child, we've heard in other situations about the issue of homelessness and how we lose families and children. I mean, certainly it applies when they move for the school districts and when they're in school. Is this something that people are talking about too under best practices of how to not lose, you know, as a family becomes homeless and is moving from place to place, that we always are there with the services that they need and that there's never a gap in services?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, that is really an excellent question, and I'm pleased to say that area is of high focus in all of our programs. We are looking to see how we can strengthen statutes and work with our community partners and our school district partners on identifying effective outreach strategies and follow-up activities. So this population is at the top of everyone's priority list right now.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you again, Ms. Burnham, for being here today. I appreciate you answering a few questions the other day as well. I did have one other, and again, I come from this from a project manager mentality, so putting on my project manager hat. What I heard on slide two is that we were awarded $4,705 or $705,605, but that we were asked to reduce that budget by 29%, which means, if I understand correctly, that we will actually receive $3,340,980 roughly. But one of the things that I do know as a project manager is generally we have a set scope and we have a set budget. And whenever we reduce the budget, that means, quite frankly, we have to reduce the scope of what we can do. So my question to you is, based on that, what is in that 29% that was de-scoped that we can no longer do?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your question. So just to clarify, the $4,705 is after the reduction. So we do receive this amount. And quite frankly, I was a little relieved when we did have to reduce, because we really shot the moon on our budget, and knowing that we only had a year to do a lot of this was putting some pressure on all of us. So the things that were eliminated in that 29% were those things kind of high on the low on the wish list. So a lot of training opportunities, and so we really prioritized the things that remained in our action plan and budget were really the top level priorities. And if you like, I would be happy to send you and the committee a chart with the key actions along with some budget information. For instance, the IT work alone is $1 million. So we are really hoping that Minute can work with us and give us some concrete direction and planning on this unique identifier and the data sharing agreement piece. We put in the budget to hire a data practices specialist to help us identify where in the data sharing agreements need revision and how they can help us make that data sharing process much more simple.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Ms. Burnham.
Representative
Bonner. Thank you so much for that. And that is music to my ears, quite frankly. And I'm also extremely delighted to hear that you have a good prioritized backlog of potential projects. And so that was very heartening to hear. So thank you for that. And if that data is available, yes, please, I would love to see it. Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Ms. Burnham, have you identified any legislation that may be needed as you're pursuing this? I guess I was wondering especially about the universal ID point, which I think can raise all kinds of issues we could get into, but I'm just wondering if the department will be coming forward with any proposed legislation related to any of this.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your question. So we have a meeting next week that's going to kind of dig into the next layer of what may be needed to identify what specific challenges exist for the data sharing agreements and for the universal identifier. Whether or not we move forward legislation, I mean, we haven't really had that conversation yet. I would imagine that some of the statute would need to be revised to some degree to allow for an ease of better data sharing.
And Ms. Burnham, if you want that to happen this session, I would encourage you to, okay, and the department to get moving on that.
Mr. Chair, I will add that to the agenda with the group on February 14th.
And a quick question in our closing seconds here. I just was surprised to see, and maybe just this hadn't clicked from your earlier presentation, and this is in the OLA presentation, that school readiness is not required to align with standards, I assume with the ESIPs, and that's just surprised me. Can you briefly just, I would think one of the advantages of that kind of program is that it would be aligned with those standards. Can you comment briefly on that?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to. I think Ms. Hauer addressed it perfectly. It's a very old statute, and it's not been revised for many years. And as she mentioned, any of the new programs coming out, We ensure that though that standard of higher quality is embedded in all those statutes. And so that's something that when we make some proposals in our strategic plan, that we, to better align those statutes, that would definitely be one thing we would do.
Thank you. Members, a reminder that there is a one-pager, and I really had thought this had been included, with an updated information from the OLA report. We'll make sure to get that out to members, and it may be that if folks want, we can have Ms. Burnham and Ms. Hauer come back in if they're willing to update us on that. And I want to apologize again for the late start this morning, really truncating things, and especially to our presenters. With that, members, we are adjourned.